Sometimes it's tragic when you get on Facebook or the internet, or when you look at the newspaper, or you get on YouTube, and you see how many problems there are in this world, when you see how many terrible decisions are made in the heat of the moment because people simply have lost the ability in certain moments of their lives to exercise self-control. We've been talking for the last couple of weeks about the idea of self-control, the idea of self-denial and self-sacrifice, and how self-control can be one of those really beneficial things in your life, and how Christian self-control is going to look an awful lot like self-denial. It's going to look an awful lot like carrying a cross. As a matter of fact, the main passage that we've kind of been going back to start off each one of these lessons comes from Luke chapter 9 and verse 23, where Jesus says, "If anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me." In the first lesson, we talked a lot about what it means to say no to ourselves, to deny ourselves. We have those urges and those moments and those passions that flare up, and we want to act out upon them. And the person who has cultivated an attitude of self-control is the person who can say no, not just to other people, but they can say no to themselves. And that's one of the most valuable skills you can learn. If you want to be successful in anything you do in life, learning to say no to those things that can hinder you from reaching that goal is really important. And if you want to grow as a Christian, if you want to grow closer to God, if you want to be the man of God that he's called you to be, or the woman of God that he wants you to be, learning how to say no to those things that get in the way is extremely valuable. We talked last week about the idea of carrying our cross and sometimes the sacrifice that is involved. We talked about ways we can actually practice discipline in our own lives. We can, in some ways, I guess you say, manufacture self-sacrifice for the sake of training us to become better at being the people that God has called us to be. Like, for example, fasting. Fasting is something where it's you're putting a difficulty in your own life as a training exercise so that you can handle difficulties when they arise naturally. That's something that there's biblical precedent for. We talked a little bit about what it means to carry our cross daily. Like when Jesus says carry your cross, on the one hand, carrying your cross is something that's a death sentence. You're carrying your cross to be executed. But when he calls Christians to do that daily, that means that this is something that it's not a one-time event. This is something where you pick it up day after day after day. In order to do that, you need strength. You need practice. That's going to take cultivating an attitude of putting others first. And so we talked last week about the idea of carrying the cross. And then today what we're going to talk about is when Jesus finishes this sentence by saying, "And you follow me." There is no better place to turn. There is no better example for us to learn what the self-controlled life is than Jesus. I started off this lesson by saying you can look at the news, you can look on YouTube, you can look on Facebook, and you'll see example after example of people who have lost self-control. You don't know how many videos of fights there are on Facebook of people who got angry at someone else while driving, the car is pulled over, and people fight. You know how many people have been seriously injured or killed because they lost self-control, and there's a stranger who made a bad decision on the road, and all of a sudden they're willing to put their life on the line because they're so mad about that? Like the idea of road rage and just completely losing all sense of what is a wise... I'll just tell you right now, it is never, ever, ever, ever a wise, prudent decision to get out of your car and to try to get into an altercation with a stranger because you don't like the way he turned. Like, that's never a good decision. Ever, ever is that a good decision. Why would anybody do that? They've lost control of themselves. They've lost their ability to think about the future, about what is the type of person you want to be. And that can happen. How many hurtful words have been said in a moment of anger that you cannot take back? You can say you're sorry, you can be forgiven, but they were always said and they'll always hurt. Like, self-control could prevent so many of the pains and tragedies that take place in this world. How many families have been destroyed because of a lack of self-control, whether it's fits of anger that can never be taken back, or whether it's words that were spoken, whether it's acts of lust outside the home, whether it's, we've talked about how often things can start innocently, and then before you know it, you're in over your head, whether it's texting a friend from work from the opposite sex. Maybe it's someone you find attractive. Maybe it's someone you find funny or likable. And all of a sudden, these text messages, they become more common, more frequently. All of a sudden, you don't really want your spouse reading your text messages, so your phone becomes a little bit more private, or you start deleting things from time to time, just every once in a while, the one that you sent that was a little bit risque. All of a sudden, that can turn into spending more time going by that person's place of work, maybe spend more time hanging out with them at lunchtime, maybe going out and getting lunch together. And all of a sudden, little by little, without thinking, I haven't done anything technically wrong yet, you end up alienating yourself from your family, and you can find yourself in a situation you never thought you'd be in. You can find yourself where little by little by little by little, you gradually descend into a hell that you've made for yourself. And now you have regret. Now your wife is someone you can't look in the eye anymore because you've been having an affair, whatever it may be. But all of these types of things, these are decisions that we make because we have lost the ability to say no to ourselves. And so what we've talked about is all the ways that self-control can actually benefit our lives and benefit our walk with God. If we're going to follow Jesus, there's no greater example to look to than Jesus himself for what the perfect picture of self-control is. Just think about what Jesus did throughout his life. You can look at his fasting. We've talked about that. Jesus was in the habit of fasting. We know about his 40-day fast. But then also Jesus regularly cultivated this practice, this discipline of going out by himself and spending like entire nights in prayer to God. It says that that was his custom. He would regularly go and spend time in prayer. That's not something you do because you're, you know, always looking for the next fun and exciting thing. That's a practice. That's a self-discipline. That's a spiritual discipline that you do in order to exercise self-control and to accomplish a spiritual task, to do something that will help you to grow closer to God. That's beneficial to you, but it takes saying no to some things to do that. Jesus, even while fasting, had to practice saying no. Remember, Satan was there and was tempting him every step of the way, whether it was about turning stones into bread or receiving the kingdoms of earth without having to die. Like, there were so many things that Satan was offering him, and yet Jesus was saying no. Look at his life. I mean, we talked about road rage a minute ago. If anyone ever had justification for losing his cool about people who were trying to harm him or trying to constantly attack him or slander him or lie about him, it was Jesus. I mean, you just read through one of the Gospels and you'll see over and over and over again, these people come up to Jesus for the sole purpose of trying to trap him. That would get really old really fast if every person who came up to me was doing so with just fake intentions, trying to make me look bad. And yet Jesus had people doing that constantly, trying to trap him, trying to discredit him, trying to make him look like a fool. And there were so many times people would accuse him, they would accuse his disciples of sin, even that they didn't commit, just so that Jesus would look bad. They would insult the company that he kept to make him look bad. All of that is the type of stuff that can make you very, very angry. How often did people come up to Jesus and say things about him that were just flat out insulting? Whether you could say that he's demon possessed, or you could say that he gets his powers from Beelzebul. He casts out demons by the ruler of the demons. And he is sitting there helping people right before their eyes, and they're discrediting all of it to give it and attribute the power to Satan or to the ruler of the demons. That would be very frustrating. People who constantly wouldn't listen, they would deny his miracles, they would deny who he was, they would try to trap him, they would lie about him. They would say he said things like, don't pay your taxes. They actually say that in his trial. There are people who are saying these types of things that just aren't. People who not only would mock and discredit and try to trap him and all of that, but actually took it to the point of violence. People who tried to get him arrested. Judas, who betrayed him to get him arrested. Jesus, who was beaten and mocked and spat upon for crimes he did not commit. Jesus, who was then tortured upon a cross. And in every step of the way, Jesus exercises self-control. Jesus doesn't lose it on them. Are there moments becomes more harsh? Yes, certainly. But even those, I think, are intentional. They're intentional for the purpose of trying to educate, trying to teach, trying to draw people closer to what his kingdom is about and to demonstrate the opposite of his kingdom. But throughout this, you see Jesus, even while on the cross, saying, "Father, forgive them. They know not what they're doing." It's like Jesus is well aware of all of those things that we talked about that start little by little and that lead to these terrible, terrible life decisions. Jesus is aware of where those things start from. Murder. All right, you want to talk about murder? A lot of people are pretty good at not murdering. You know, like not many people do that. But Jesus is saying, how does that happen? Like, how do you get to the point where a person who never thought he would murder someone actually goes about doing it? Well, look at the words the person uses. Look at the thoughts that the person has in their heart. In the Sermon on the Mount, he takes these terrible sins that it's like, okay, just avoid that. But he says, no, there's actually a route here that can lead you down a path that could result in that. Even if you don't believe it's possible, it can happen. I listen to enough of those, you know, crime shows to know that people who never thought they would murder actually get engaged in it. Why? It's because they've lost the ability to put an end to something that's slowly spiraling, and then it starts becoming a bigger spiral and looser and faster, and all of a sudden they find themselves where they never thought possible. It can happen. It can happen to anybody. It can happen to you. It can happen to me, which is why we need to be on guard, which is why we need to, as Paul writes, let him who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall. Like, falls happen. They happen a lot. And so whatever it is, whether you're talking about adultery, Jesus says, let's peel that back to what the original root is here. It's lust. Like, there are things that are not just about your actions, but they also go back to your words. They go back even to your thoughts. And so Jesus, I believe, when he would spend those evenings in prayer, yes, they're about his actions. They're about his words. But he's trying to change even his whole view of the world. He's trying to change his thoughts into conformity with what God would want them to be. And I think that's what makes him such a perfect example for us. There's no greater example than of self-control than the one who, though he is the teacher and the Lord, gets down on his hands and knees and washes the feet of his disciples. Why would he do that? Well, it's a reminder. It's a lesson. It's an example of what it means to be part of the kingdom. And it's not about saying yes to yourself about everything. And it's not about always getting what you think you want or you think you deserve. It's actually about saying no. It's actually about carrying a cross. It's actually about service. It's about putting other people even above yourself. Throughout the Gospels, throughout the New Testament, there's this constant call to follow and to go even where you don't want to go. Look with me at the end of the Gospel of John. In John chapter 21, Jesus is walking with Peter and the beloved disciples, you know, back there a little ways, kind of following. And Peter and Jesus are having a conversation. And it's a conversation you get the impression Peter would rather not be having. I think Peter feels the pressure. The light is on him. He's having to give an account, in essence, for his attitudes towards Jesus. Jesus keeps asking him, "Do you love me?" And Peter keeps saying yes, and then Peter's given a responsibility. But this happens a number of times. And then you get to verse 18 of John chapter 21, and Jesus tells Peter something. He says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were younger, you used to gird yourself and walk wherever you wished. But when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands, and someone else will gird you and bring you where you do not wish to go." Now he said this, signifying by what kind of death he would glorify God. And when he had spoken this, he said to him, "Follow me." So we're talking now about the idea of self-control, self-denial, as it comes to following Jesus. You know, when he says, "Deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me." Here he's telling Peter, "You follow me," but he gives him an example of what that's going to look like. It doesn't look like what Peter did when he was a young man. When Peter was a young man, he girded himself, he walked where he wished, he did as he pleased. That's not the example of following Jesus. That's the example of the person who says yes to themselves. That's the example of the person who feels like he has everything under control and feels like he's in control of his own life and his own world and his own destiny. But what Jesus is saying is, to truly follow me, things are going to happen that you might not like. To truly follow me means you might go places you don't want to go. He actually mentions the idea of your hands being stretched out. Then he says that to signify what kind of death by which he would glorify God. He would glorify God through his death in crucifixion. That's what Jesus is saying to Peter right here. That's what it means to carry your cross in the literalist ways to follow after him. And so here is this call, not to walk wherever you please and to do as you wish and to be a man who's in control of your own life and destiny, but to give that up to follow somebody else. And it's to follow Jesus, the one who washes feet, the one who shows love even towards his enemies, the one who fasts and prays regularly to cultivate a life of spiritual discipline and thoughts that are in tune with the will of God. You see this idea of following Jesus play out throughout the New Testament. Look with me at Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5 is in the midst of a rather lengthy section describing what it means to walk as a Christian. Like, how do you live and walk in the journey of the Christian life? And one of the things that you'll see repeatedly through this is it's an attitude of self-control, of self-denial, for the sake of something and someone greater than you. But throughout it, there are these calls for imitation, imitating God and imitating Christ. And you'll see that throughout, and that's really what the following Jesus is. You know, at this point, when we talk about following Jesus, you know, he lived in Galilee. It doesn't mean you have to hop a plane to Galilee and go walk in his literal footsteps. What it means is you imitate his manner and style of life. And you think, the age-old question, what would Jesus do? You know, when you are facing a temptation or when you're faced with a circumstance and you can respond with anger or malice or insult or lust or whatever it may be, what would following Jesus look like in this situation? What you see in Ephesians chapter 5 is a pretty good example for a lot of areas of life, what it would look like to follow Jesus. Chapter 5 and verse 1 says, "Therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children and walk in love." So if you're going to follow Jesus, it's going to mean a couple things. One, it'll be imitating God, and the other one, it'll be walking in love. What does it mean to walk in love? Well, the death of Jesus on the cross is going to be the primary example that he will always go back to for what the definition of love is. If you want to know what love is in the Bible, the word love, like in our culture, gets thrown around so flippantly. It doesn't put a solid idea in your head. If you can talk about loving nachos just as much as you talk about loving your grandma, just as much as you talk about loving your child, like, that's kind of weird that one word would cover so much ground. If you want to talk about love in the Bible, there's no better picture of like an actual image of love than seeing the cross itself. The cross is the perfect definition of what love in the Bible is all about. And so when he says, walk in love, verse 2, notice what he likens that to. Just as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for us. That second phrase is helping us interpret the first one. You walk in love because Jesus loved you. Do it just like Jesus loved you. And then remember the cross. He gave himself up for you. That's what it means to walk in love. So how do I give myself up for one another? Well, you can keep reading, and you can see that it'll impact the whole manner of life, the decisions you make, the style of life that you live. Look at verse 3. But fornication and impurity and greed, they must not be named among you as proper among the saints. By the way, every one of those things he just mentioned right there, they're a lack of self-control. Greed, that's where you let desire for money take over your life. Lust or fornication, you're letting the desire for sexual sin overwhelm your life and your senses. The ability to say no to money, the ability to say no to fornication, that's what walking in love looks like. You go to verse 4, and there must be no filthiness or silly talk or coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather the giving of thanks. So notice verse 3 dealt with things you do with, like, whether it's, you know, sex or with your money and things like that. And then you're getting in verse 4 some of the words you say, your, you know, filthy words, silly talk, like, you know, joking about things probably which ought not be joked about. Those types of things are just flippancy with your words, flippancy with your actions. You can continue on. Look at verse 5. For this you know with certainty, that no immoral or impure person or covetous person who is an idolater has an inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. Let no one deceive you with empty words, For because of these things, the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. That's a way of saying this is actually serious. Like what we're talking about is actually a serious thing. God is aware of the lives that we live. God actually is a just judge, and God does punish immorality and sinfulness and wickedness. Self-control matters. The wrath of God is not something that you want coming down upon you. What you do matters. The life that you live matters. So verse 7 says, don't be partakers with them. People who live in such a way that will pull you down that path, don't fellowship with them. Don't be partakers with them. Because that's how you once walked in verse 8. You were formerly darkness, but now in the light of the Lord, walk as children of light. So he tells us in verse 2 to walk in love. Verse 8, walk as children of light. If you skip down to verse 15, he'll say, be careful how you walk, not as unwise, but as wise. The self-controlled person will walk in love following the example of Jesus. They'll walk as children of light, following the morals and the teachings of Jesus. They'll walk in wisdom, living the type of life that Jesus calls us to live. You know, as you go through, he'll then talk about, in verse 21, being submissive or subject to one another. He'll talk about what that looks like in the family life. But if you're going to be submissive, submission is itself an act of self-control and self-denial. It's putting another person above yourself. And he shows, what does it look like when husbands are submissive to wives and when wives are submissive to husbands? What's that going to look like in the family life? Well, it'll look a lot like wives honoring their husbands and husbands loving their wives so much that they would die for them. By the way, that idea, look at verse 25. Husbands, love your wives. Okay, what does that look like? We talked about love being kind of this hard to define thing. What does it look like for a husband to love his wife? Just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her. Oh, it goes right back to the cross again. It's like the cross becomes this image of imitate God and walk in love just as Christ loved you and gave himself up for you. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her. The idea of love is seen in the fact that you're willing to carry your cross for another person. In the home, it means you put the other person above yourself. It means you're willing to sacrifice your will for someone else. You know when you can see what the self-controlled, self-denial, carrying your own cross and following Jesus looks like in the home? When the husband puts the wife's will above his own will. When the wife follows and loves and honors her husband. When they actually submit to one another in the fear of Christ, so that no one is dominating or domineering over someone else to get their own will all the time. That's not what we're ever called to do as Christians. Rather, what you do is you look at what's best for another person, and out of love and humility and submission, you consider that person above yourself. Sounds a little bit like self-control. Like it sounds a little bit like if you're going to do that, you're not just acting upon your whims and momentary passions and losing your temper and acting upon lust and all of these things, but rather you're letting Christ cultivate and change the way you live, whether it's in your actions, whether it's in your words, whether it's in your thoughts, whether it's in your family. I want to close by looking at one passage in the book of 1 Peter. So turn with me now to 1 Peter, and we're going to kind of see how Peter uses Jesus as our ultimate example. We've talked about some of the ways that a lack of self-control leads to the downfall of so many people's families and jobs and lives and all of those things. And we've talked about how Jesus is ultimately our example for what it means to be self-controlled. And I feel like there's a lot of self-control is such a broad topic that saying walk in love, that you can only do that if there's self-control involved. Saying submit to one another, you can only do that if there's self-control involved. Saying deny fornication or greed or worldly lusts or anger or violence, you can only do that if you're exercising and practicing self-control. Self-control, we talked about this, it's actually one of the things that the Spirit produces in the life of a follower. It's not something that you'll always be able to just through your own grit and strength muster up for yourself. Self-control is a gift from God that the Spirit gives and the Spirit produces in life. But how is that going to happen? Well, it's going to happen by giving yourself over to the will of God and to accepting the what the Spirit is doing and producing in your life. You can reject and grieve the Spirit. That's a thing you can actually do. And so we're called to be people who are self-controlled and allow these things to be produced in our lives. If you look at chapter 2 in verse 21 of 1 Peter, it says, "For you have been called for this purpose." All right, so if you've ever been wondered, if you've ever wondered for what purpose you were called to be a Christian, you're about to read it. It's important to know that. "You have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving an example that you should follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. While being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously." All right, just think about those expressions right there. First off, he says in verse 21 that Christ has left us an example that we should follow in his steps. So whenever we find ourselves in these situations, we have the path before us set by Jesus as to how we ought to respond. And so verse 22, he committed no sin and deceit was not found in his mouth. So if following the example of Jesus, which by the way, we will fail to do, but following the example of Jesus, you try to avoid choosing sin and you try to avoid deception and lying. If you look at verse 23, while being reviled, this is a tough one, he did not revile in return. It's like when people are saying these terrible things about Jesus, he doesn't stoop down to their level. That's one of the things that self-control, I believe, helps us do. You always stay committed to Jesus. You always let him be your example. What so often can happen is the person who is cruel to us, they become our example. And if I can respond back with a proper level of cruelty that somewhat matches their own, maybe is a little better than theirs, then I can make them feel bad and I can still have my self-righteousness that I wasn't quite as bad as them. Yet what that's doing is that's lowering the bar of what Jesus calls us to do, and it lowers it to the level of the person who's being cruel to you. That's not what we're called to do. That's not what Jesus has challenged us with, to model and imitate the behavior of those around us. Rather, we're called to model and imitate his behavior. So even while being reviled, he did not revile. He didn't use his words to harm. And even while suffering, he uttered no threats. That's kind of incredible. You know, while suffering, he didn't even use his words to threaten. It's not like, it doesn't even say, and while suffering, he didn't make them suffer. He didn't do that. But even more than that, he didn't even respond with threat. Like, while suffering on the cross, look at the words of Jesus. He's saving the thief next to him. He's praying for the forgiveness of those doing it. He's not up there saying, "You sinful and rotten world, I can't wait until I get to reap down hell and judgment upon you." Like, that's not the attitude Jesus had while on the cross. Rather, it was an attitude of love. It was our example that we follow. So you can read through here, and then in verses 24 and 25, he's going to rely heavily on the language and imagery of Isaiah 53 about that suffering servant who gave himself for many. It says in verse 24, "He himself bore our sins in his body on the cross so that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. For by his wounds we are healed. For you were continually straying like sheep and have returned to the shepherd and guardian of your souls." So this idea here of following Jesus, following him through self-control, following him through not letting desire for vengeance or just any passions or desires that we have take over our life, he uses Jesus as an example of what that looks like. But notice also that this passage comes right in the middle of a list of ways that we are called to behave in different areas of our life. So, like, and by the way, submission is going to be one of the main words that he uses to describe what that looks like. But, like, chapter 2 and verse 12. "Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that the thing in which they slander you is evildoers. They may, because of your good deeds as they observe them, glorify God on the day of visitation." So Jesus is our example. I think that's the centerpiece of this whole conversation. And that's going to alter and affect the way that we live among outsiders. It's going to, if you look at verse 13, "Submit yourself for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether a king or an authority." It'll impact the way we view politics and government. How do you view politics and government with the self-control and the example of Jesus, not by reviling or threatening or getting angry or screaming and all that, but rather you model the love of Jesus when it comes to politics. When it comes, verse 18, servants, be submissive to your masters with all respect. When it comes to dealing with those who have a higher rank than you in society, or the people who are your bosses, or different things like that, even sometimes when they are cruel or ungodly men, we continue to follow the example of Jesus in that. That takes self-control. In our families, chapter 3, in the same way, wives are supposed to be submissive. That is something that requires an attitude of self-control. When you look at verse 7, you husbands, in the same way, live in an understanding way with your wives. Like, that is in the household, showing self-control and love. If you look down at verse 8 of chapter 3, to sum up, all of you be harmonious, sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted, and humble in spirit, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult. Why? Because Jesus didn't do that, and he's our example. Not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but rather giving a blessing instead. For you were called for this very purpose. There's that language again. That's why you were called, to model Jesus to the world around you, whether it's in politics, whether it's in the workplace, whether it's in your household, whether it's among one another as brothers and sisters in Christ, whether it's when you're alone at night, whether it's with your girlfriend, whether it's when you're on the road and you're getting angry at that car driving next to you, whether it's when you're filing your taxes and you're trying to think of what would be most beneficial versus what might be the most honest, or whatever it may be, all of these areas where we have these temptations that pull us away from the example of the self-sacrifice and self-denial and self-control modeled by Jesus, we're called to remember who he is, remember what he has done, to deny ourselves, to take up our crosses daily, and to follow him. Follow him in the way you respond. Follow him in what you do. If there's anyone here this morning who you have sin in your life that you would like the help and prayers of this church to help strengthen you and encourage you to overcome, if you've been lacking self-control and letting certain areas of your life get out of hand, we would love to help you with that in any way that we can. If there's anyone here who wants to become a Christian, name Jesus as Lord of your life, have your sins washed away in baptism, and begin a new life in him, please let that be known. You can tell our elders. We'll have some in the library in the back who you can have a private conversation with, or you can come up here to the front row and you can let us know as a body of believers, and we will comfort and encourage you in any way we can. If you would let us know, please come while we stand and as we sing.